Hello, this is Christine DeVivier, and I am here today with Margaret Greenberg and Senya Mayman. And hi, Margaret and Senya.
Hi,
Hi,
Christine.
Christine. So I know, Senya, you're talking to us from sunny Palo Alto, and Margaret, I know you're an East Coaster and
East
based
Coast,
in Connecticut.
in the quiet corner of Connecticut.
Oh, terrific. So, and then I'm up here near Boston. So, this is great. I love technology that we can all be here together. So, what I'd love to do today, we are here talking with the authors of a brand new book, a fantastic book called Profit from the Positive. It's Proven Leadership Strategies to Boost Productivity and Transform Your Business. And Margaret and Senya are the authors, and I'm just thrilled that you've done this, guys. This is terrific.
Thank you.
I wanted to just start. I met Margaret and Senya originally because we all graduated from the Masters in Positive Psychology program at University of Pennsylvania. And you two, I was in the second year of the program, and frankly, we thought we were pretty pioneering, going into only the second year that this field even existed. But you two were in it from day one, the very first year. So you were truly pioneers. And I just thought we could start for a moment. Like, what attracted you to positive psychology? I mean, you're both coaches, you both work in business. Do facilitation and that sort of thing. What attracted you to positive psychology and made you such pioneering spirits in the field?
I'll start with this one, Christine. Actually, I was not at a point in my career where I was looking to go back to school to get a master's and really in anything at that point. But this announcement came across my email, and I read it, and it just spoke to me so much so that I thought, oh my gosh, coaching is the art. And I had been doing that. I was certified in 2003 by CTI as a coach and had been practicing in the corporate world. And so this was in 2005, and I thought, but what's missing is we don't have the science behind why coaching works and some of the tools and exercises that we have, clients do. So that's what really attracted me. And then to be, in the city of brotherly love in Philadelphia and people from all over the world, and I just felt like I had to do it. I had to apply and see if I could get in. And the rest is kind of
Fantastic.
history. Senya?
Fantastic.
This is Senya. For me, it was the beginning of a career change, actually, studying positive psychology. So, Christine, I'm delighted that Margaret and I are speaking to you, especially given that you are in the business world. There is, many people don't know the Masters of Applied Positive Psychology program at UPenn, and it really brings in people from all domains, from education, from business, from nonprofits, from community work. And I really enjoy speaking with those of us who are focused on business because we can apply these research findings to business. And I know you've done this, Christine. Margaret and I do this. When I started, I saw the announcement. I had read Learned Optimism by Marty Seligman, the founder of this program. I'd read that when I was an entrepreneur and running a company of 7 full-time people and 22 people total. We had a lot of contractors. So I was co-running this company and had read Learned Optimism, and it really resonated with me as a business person, even though it's a book on psychology. And it resonated in that a startup is such a roller coaster, and everybody who's at a startup, running a startup, will tell you that there are such high highs where the client really wants your product and the client is excited about what you're delivering, and there are such low lows when things just don't work out, or the person who's been your main contact at this large company leaves, and so that project breaks down. So all of these things happen, and learned optimism and resilience is a great way to address it. So I had seen these similar concepts to positive psychology work in my business life. And then when I saw the program, I thought it's the same reason that I took Japanese in college. I just thought it would be super, super, super interesting and had no idea how it would relate to my work. But then when I speak about the career change, two things happened after I started the program. One is, as a result of the program, I became an executive coach and started working primarily with entrepreneurs. And second is I got the research bug. And that occupied me for the past about 6 years, is really doing research on concepts of motivation and where business and organizational behavior, where they overlap and can get people to be their best. So in two ways, through coaching and through research. And as you know, Christine, I just completed my PhD last year at Stanford in organizational behavior. So that's a direct. So I often, when I see Marty Seligman, who the three of us on the call know, but others may not know, he's the founder, one of the founding heads of positive psychology. When I see him and I tell him what I'm up to, I thank him for helping me find a career that I really love. So for me, it was a career changer.
Well, that's phenomenal. Thank you both. I love the way you both got into it. And, you know, one of the things that strikes me is, and Senya, you certainly spoke to this, but both of you, and frankly, you know, a lot of people in the early days of the field are really, you know, pioneering spirits, right? To just go into this new field, take a year out of your life and a lot of expense and travel and time, and go into this. I mean, it wasn't just going back to school. This is a whole new field that obviously was exciting to both of you, and you could see applications in business or potential applications in business. And it strikes me that, you know, maybe that willingness to be innovative and pioneering, I would imagine a lot of your clients have some similar characteristics. And does that spirit that you have, does that help you carry over into any of the work you do with clients?
Roger, feel free to start.
Yeah, I'll start with that one. Having just participated myself earlier this week in a coaching workshop, I'm always looking to add right to the toolkit and right, advance the profession. And I heard Judy Neal, who used to be at Yale, now she's at the University of Arkansas, who's also a coach. She did a program earlier this week through ICF called it the Edge Walkers, people that kind of walk on the edge, right?
Mm.
And they tend to be, you know, quote, pioneers. They tend to be really curious about the future and often get involved in things before they become a trend, but they see the possibility. And the other interesting characteristic about these edge walkers is that they don't see at the time what they're doing as risk-taking. But others will say, wow, that was a big risk. You went back to school at your age, and you had a full-time business that you were running and a family. Like, wow, that was a big risk that you took. And I don't perceive it that way at all. And I think in the coaching of our clients, some of them, too, are edge walkers. Some of them clearly are pursuing new things. I have one client right now who's a CIO of a company, a large Fortune 200 company, and he went back to school at age 50-something to get a graduate degree from Tufts in museum studies. Because it's a passion that he has, and through our coaching, he kind of got uncovered. So sometimes I think it helps clients see when we do something that may be perceived as high risk, like, it builds that self-efficacy where, wow, maybe I could do that too. But then many of them are already these edge walkers and are doing amazing, incredible things, and it's like such a joy to coach.
Yeah, that's great, Margaret. I love that there's a name for people like us.
Yeah, there's another name too, edge walkers, and then in another study she cited, they're called cultural creatives.
Oh, okay, cultural
creatives. Okay, so that's some more info, some more lingo to pass along, but yeah,
well,
it's a really fascinating study.
I'm sure, all edge walkers can relate, but until there was a name like edge walkers or cultural creatives, I just thought we were a little odd. So.
Well, there are quite a few of us.
So that's great. Yeah. Senya, did you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I'd love to add one other comment. You mentioned that in doing something like MAP, the three of us have an interest in learning something new and figuring out how something new can apply to how we can help our clients. And I do see that in quite a few of the clients that I work with, both coaching and also I was thinking more consulting. So both Margaret and I do this. And when I last spoke to you, Christine, about your work, you also do this. I will go into a business and speak with them. They might be doing an offsite on, let's say, change management that has come up. And they will want to know what is the latest. So what is the latest on research that can help them with the particular issues that they're working on?
Mm-hmm.
And I find that those people, whether it's the HR people or the people in charge of the marketing group, when I'm coming in to do this to a marketing group, whoever it is, they are extremely interested and innovative. It's almost like they have a learning mindset. So they want to figure things out. They're even okay with some things flopping as long as they have the potential to really bring their team to the next level. And I find one characteristic of people like this in companies who want to bring new tools and new exciting ways of helping people do business to their teams. One thing that they're looking for often, I find, is counterintuitive results. And Marte and I really focused on that in Profit from the Positive. Because to us, too, that was intriguing when we learned about it. So I'll give you just an example from the book. Everybody knows, and everybody in business knows, that setting a goal is good. Setting a goal is an important, good thing to do. But people just don't think that sometimes when setting a goal doesn't work out for them on a particular project, what else can they do? So the fact that, for example, in our book, we have this one recommendation, which is basically if-then plan, setting an if-then intention. That is twice as likely to work as setting a goal, but people don't think about it. So people know that setting a goal is good. But these innovative HR people, innovative leaders, innovative managers, they want to know what is the edge. So I've been setting goals all my life, a leader might think. I've been telling my team to set goals. What can I do that's more on the edge? And that's why Margaret and I in Process in the Positive, we talk about how can a habit be better than a goal in some case, or how can setting a specific place and time where you're going to do something, how can that more than double the odds that you're going to accomplish your goal? So things like that. To give people the same excitement that we found. What is counterintuitive?
I love that, Senya. Thank you. And yeah, I mean, one of the things, I have a list of things I want to talk to you about from your book, and one of them was, you know, where you talk about, I think it's in chapter one, create a new habit on top of the old. And I just thought, you know, I love that. I love that you talk about it that way. And the fact that you say, you know, a habit is better even than a goal.
So I'd love to touch on this one. There's a researcher at MIT. Her name is Anne Grable. She studies the brain. And basically, she says that the way that habits work, it's a path. It's like imagine hiking. Imagine hiking in the wilderness. It is a path that 100 people have walked through, so 100 of your thoughts and actions. But if you want to change your habit, you're going to have to start a different path. You won't be able to cover up this path, whatever your habit is. So if your habit is having 3 croissants in the morning, that habit is going to be hard to cover up. But if you start another habit, which is the evening before you set out your sneakers and your workout clothes, and you actually put them on first thing in the morning and you go walking, that you can get 100 people walking through that path. So 100 thoughts and action repetitions of that habit. And Margaret and I are really excited about that, just the idea that you really can change, not by trying to remove a habit, but by trying to build a new habit. Margaret, do you want to add to that on our habits work? Margaret?
Well, sorry about that. I was going to say I have a real concrete example that's occurring in my family right now. My husband likes to, at around 8:30, 9 o'clock at night, go for some kind of sugary treat, and he was really trying to break that habit and just not do it, just not do it. And I said, honey, you can't break a habit. You've got to replace it with something else. So I'm like, what could that other else be? And, well, he's an amazing guitarist. And so what does he do now when he has this urge for this suite? He moved his guitar up into the living room instead of where it was in his office, and he picks up the guitar and he starts to play. So he's created
awesome.
A new habit. The habit is one of reaching for the guitar versus reaching for that ice cream.
I love it. That's nice. All great examples and metaphors. Thank you. And another thing you talk about in the book that I loved, and this is in Chapter 7, you talk about a 36% performance increase when you focus on employee strengths during performance reviews versus typical performance reviews. And, you know, I think that's not something that people really know, and not something people know in any sort of big way. So do you want to just talk a little bit about that? I mean, I think that's just such an important finding for leaders to understand.
Sure. I came out of the world of HR. That's where I spent the first 15 years of my career. So I was intimately familiar with performance reviews, mm-hmm. both from an HR perspective as the process, as well as an employee who had to conduct performance reviews for my team, as well as participate in one for myself. And so when Senya and I started writing this book, and we were asking our clients, you know, where are some of their business challenges? Not what do they want to know about positive psychology, but what are some of their business challenges that we thought positive psychology perhaps could be a potential solution. And performance reviews definitely came back as one of the challenges that we heard from our clients, that, oh, my gosh, they're so dreaded, they're so awful. You know, what could we do to make them better or do away with them? We say in the chapter, change them or chuck them completely, mm-hmm. And some companies are. But the focusing on strengths is some companies are beginning to recognize that, and they are actually putting in the actual performance review, you know, template, you know, what are your strengths and how can you develop them further, which that was, you know, years ago, mm-hmm. that still in some companies today, that notion of developing strengths as part mm-hmm. of your development plan is still foreign, but it is starting to catch on. The funny thing is, when it comes to actually having a performance review and sitting down with an employee, we've had both employees and managers tell us that even though they want to talk about the strengths, people often skip right over them.
Yeah.
And right, they and you probably find that, Christine, even in your coaching, right,
mm-hmm.
where you want a client to really own their strengths, and they were like, well, wait, but let's get into my gaps. Let's get into where I
exactly.
you know, develop. And they don't see that really they could develop their strengths even more and be incredibly successful if they focused on some of those things. So I think it is starting to change from what we're hearing, you know, with our clients and other companies.
Mm-hmm.
But there's still mm-hmm. a long way to go.
Yeah, I think still a long way to go. But certainly putting data out there, like the data that you put in the book, you know, you talked about the 36% performance
mm-hmm.
improvement. You talked about earlier in the book in Chapter 4, you had mentioned the 17% increase in sales when they're focused
yeah.
on their strengths and getting feedback about their strengths. So I think as leaders, as HR professionals, as others in the business world, see more of that data. And also, frankly, I mean, I'm sure you guys have seen this too, but I see what I see a lot of times is as soon as they experience it for themselves, when they engage people through strengths, they almost don't need data because they see it right in front of their faces.
But
I love that you put the
data
in there. It's great to have the data, and I love that you put it out there.
I agree with you, Christine. There's something about the experiential experience of a lot of positive psychology research that just converts people because they can sense, they can tell in the rapport with their team members, they can tell in the rapport with their bosses, they can tell that things are working. I agree with you. There's just something after you experience it that converts you because you see it working.
Yeah. And I did love that in Chapter 7, you also talked about, well, what do you do about giving tough feedback? And, you know, because that's obviously one of the things that comes up when, you know, leaders or managers start thinking about talking to people about strengths. It's like, well, yeah, but what if I have some tough feedback to give somebody? And one of the things I loved was that you pointed out an example. You gave an example of a leader who responded to an employee with curiosity. Right? It was around a situation where the employee wasn't performing the way they needed to. And you said that the leader came at it from a point of view with curiosity. And that's so powerful, and that's so doable.
And
don't
that's a core coaching competency, right?
Mm-hmm.
In coaching is being really curious. And
mm-hmm.
I think when we work with, you know, managers, business leaders, when we can try to really cultivate that curiosity in
mm-hmm.
them,
mm-hmm.
Which is, for many people, it's already there, but it's just it's not, they don't see it as anything special, but it is. So sometimes we'll you know, draw out that flow chart, you know, and actually teach it to them mm-hmm. on the skill versus challenge, and mm-hmm. use that as almost like a diagnostic to try to understand when somebody isn't performing well. And you do need to deliver some tough feedback. Let's work with the employee. Let's find out what's really going on with them.
Yeah.
And see if this can help diagnose what's happening.
Yes. Well, and that gets into, you called it in Chapter 6, don't fire poor performers. I love it. You have a number of things in the book that phrases or titles the way you say something. But, you know, one of the ones that's really catchy is don't fire poor performers. And I think you go on to say fire them up or something like that. But, you know, I think that's pretty attention getting for a lot of people. Don't fire poor performers. And I know you guys go into talking about helping them find flow and use flow as a way of improving performance. So can you just talk a little bit about that?
Sure. There's this research on flow. It was started by a researcher. His name is Mike Csikszentmihalyi. And one of the wonderful things I think about this is the story of how he came to find this concept. He's a psychologist, and he was not studying the concept of flow. He was a rock climber in his spare time on the weekends. And as a rock climber, he would find that often he would get to the cliff with his friends, and they would be climbing basically most of the day, and suddenly they'd all realize, oh, it's getting dark, we should go home. And they come back down and unpack their things. And he was really caught up in, what is this that's going on? Sometimes we lose track of time, and we don't even remember to have lunch. We're so busy, we're so focused. And another component of flow is that you have a focus on the big goal. How do I get to the top of this cliff? At the same time that you have really good attention to the small details of where do I literally put my handholds and my footholds. And that, while this is a rock climbing analogy, people can see that in basically any field is what Csikszentmihalyi found. He then went on to study programmers and artists and a lot of people that get really engaged and really caught up in what they're doing. For example, one of the ways that Margaret and I have found that really resonates with business people, and we describe it as, to ask business people, what is a time when you have really felt in the zone with your work?
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about poor performers, they are often not feeling in the zone. Something is off. And as their manager, what kind of discussion can you have with them? So I'm going to draw back a little bit and make a little bit of a meta point. When Margaret and I were talking, even initially, about writing this kind of book, I was doing executive coaching to entrepreneurs, and Margaret was working with executives of financial companies, so CXOs. And we found that the same kinds of things were coming up. We found, for example, flow is this great model that as soon as you describe it to a manager, that manager wants to right after the coaching call, just get to an employee and discuss this model with the employee in terms of both the manager and the employee being able to see, okay, what is going on? Where are we off? Why aren't you in the zone, and what can I as your manager do to help you get there?
Yeah.
So basically, to summarize one more detail for people on this call who may not know flow as much, is then this researcher, Csikszentmihalyi, stepped back, and even that big goals and also small steps and awareness and being in the zone, he was actually able to quantify it by a really simple model of your skills and your challenges. So when your level of skill and your level of challenge matches, you get in that zone. And what's ironic about that is it can be at your highest level of skill and at a highest level of challenge, but it can also be at a low level of skill, like driving your car, and a low level of challenge, but you can get into that thinking and processing and really being in the zone. So with a poor performer, you'd have to ask, where are you? How do your skills match your challenges? Are you over-challenged? Do I need to give you some more training? Can I help you with your skills? As a manager, you can have that discussion. And it doesn't feel personal. I think, Christine, I don't know, Margaret, if you would agree with this. I think one thing about the flow model is that it takes away that feeling of, okay, we are discussing your issues. It makes it more objective, and it's not personal. It's, look, here's the situation. Where are your skills? Where are your challenges? Let's talk about it. How can we help?
No, I totally agree, Senya. I would just probably, the only caveat I would have is, you know, after, you know, a manager has had this discussion and they've put together a plan together on, you know, how to improve performance, be it the skill building that needs to occur, or maybe they need a bigger challenge, they're kind of checked out because they don't feel challenged anymore. If things still haven't improved, then obviously it's time to take a look at, hey, maybe this is just a poor job fit. Given the person's strengths, maybe they're in a role that really doesn't play to their strengths and their interests. And so then it becomes a conversation of, you know, posting for a job in another department or looking for another job outside the company, because chances are the employee is not happy. You're not happy with his performance, and he's probably not happy either doing what he's doing.
Yeah.
So there comes a point where, you know, if it's not improving, then obviously you have to take another approach.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you for that. That's great. And that's a great example. That, and again, you know, something that I think that you include in this book, like so many of the things that you have here, that are just tools that people can immediately begin to use. So I love that.
I'm really glad you said that, Christine. I'm glad you feel that way, because you're in the same business as us. You work with companies, you do coaching, you do consulting. So I'm really glad that you have that feeling and that sense. We have heard that, and we're really glad that people feel like they don't, it's not a course they have to go through. They don't have to, it's not a textbook at all. It's case study, it's story based. One person told us they read it on an airplane ride from Texas to DC. That's what we'd like you to be able to do.
Terrific. Yeah. And it's broken up into nice little chunks too, so you don't have to absorb everything all at once, which I think is terrific. In fact, I noticed on your page for the book, you say the no cost, no permission guide, which I love. you know, no big investment, don't have to get permission from someone else. I'm guessing that's what you mean by that. I love it.
Absolutely. In fact, when we say no cost, it means that you don't have to have any outlay of capital, right, mm-hmm. to implement these tools. It's not like some big program du jour that you're bringing into this company and requires all these resources. You really can begin implementing these tools today. And you don't need to get your boss's approval or HR's approval. Sure, if you're going to start, you know, revamping performance reviews and things like that, then, yeah, maybe you initiate a team that examines, you know, performance reviews in your company and looks for ways to, you know, improve them. But other than that, you can do any of these things yourself and with your team. And that's how we did break up the book. You know, part one is all about yourself as a leader. That applies to anyone. We've had people actually tell us that who aren't even in the business world that these tools apply to them. And then the second part of the book is about how you can apply these tools, you know, to hiring and performance reviews, meetings, et cetera, to your employees, to your team.
Yeah, which is a really nice way of organizing the material. You have a few things in the applying it to yourself section that I wanted to just ask you about. I mean, one of them is, I don't know how you pronounce the company's name, Everfi or Everfee, but
correct.
You talk
Everfi.
About Everfi, and you talk about, do they really have unlimited paid time off?
Yes, they do.
I talk about a counterintuitive finding. I think for a lot of leaders.
And the interesting thing, it attracts, that company is a little north of 100 people now. And they're, you know, across the United States, they're based out of D.C., and they attract a lot of young people, you know, 20-somethings. And they also use Teach for America as part of their vetting process. So they know that, okay, anybody that survived Teach for America are probably, you can throw them into a different city, a different place, and they're going to survive and flourish you know, have good leadership skills. And when we interviewed the co-founder of that company, I remember I this didn't get into the book, but I said, you know, have you seen any abuses of this, you know, policy? And he said, no, except for maybe myself. And he laughed. But it was just, something that they decided was really important to the people that they wanted to attract. And the funny thing is, people, because of the flexibility that they have, it's not like people are taking vacation all the time. They work really, really hard.
Yeah.
And then when they decide to take a break and vacation, you know, obviously they have to get their manager's approval to make sure not everybody's out at the same time. But it is truly unlimited. They do not track it.
Fantastic. That's
all about
amazing.
Getting your work done.
Yeah, which is such a refreshing way of thinking about it. I'm sure scary for a lot of people to think about, but what a great example.
He said, if I have to worry about, you know, vacation schedules and things like that, he goes, that's taking me away from my core business, and I don't want to have to be worrying about that stuff. So we make sure we hire people that are really trustworthy and can take on that kind of responsibility.
Yeah.
And he doesn't want to be in the time tracking business.
Terrific. Well, and the other thing that this probably ties into, I would guess, is what you were talking about a few minutes ago, flow, right? If people are really jazzed about what they're doing, really excited about the challenges, and feeling like they're in the zone a lot in terms of what they're trying to accomplish, who needs a vacation, right?
Well, we do believe it's important to unplug, though.
That's
you talk
true.
About that in chapter one,
That's
right, Sonia?
You do. You do a good job. Actually, you talk about it right when you talk about this, so it's a very good point. But I am thinking, you know, it's less likely they're going to abuse it because they're getting into flow and work, right?
Right. They're doing something they really want to be doing, absolutely.
Yeah. Another one you talk about is what you said. You talk about Chip Conley at the Joie de Vivre Hotels. And I love this, the Mistake of the Month Club. I mean, what a brilliant way to do innovation. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think he kind of stumbled onto it himself when he was running Joie de Vivre, because he realized, oh, my gosh, we can actually learn a lot from the big mistakes that people are making. And we should make it fine for people to bring their mistakes to this more public forum of manager gathering. So when we do that, It implies, the message gets sent from him directly from the top of the organization. Mistakes are okay. I want to share it with you. So I'll give you another example that we learned about after the book. It's actually an example that's available online. Google, in its early days, in one of the groups on Google, one of the groups in Google, they had a weekly meeting, and at each meeting, two different animals would get passed around, the dog and the monkey. So the dog was the success dog. It was the success story. So people would sit in the round and describe what was going on in their group, in their department. And the success dog would get thrown from one person in that week to another person. It would get thrown across the room to the person who really shared a great success story. And then the meddling monkey would also get thrown. That was the story of the situation that didn't work out, that really people thought should have worked out, and it didn't. And it was a good learning experience. And why was that a learning experience, and what came out of it? So that got tossed around the room as well, across the room. That is just, I think it's such a visual, supportive way of saying, yes, we really believe this as a group, as a department, as an organization. We're not just talking about mistakes of the month. Christine, do you remember the first Penguin Award? I think we write about it in the book.
Oh, well, remind everybody on the call for that.
It's very similar to this idea of allowing failure. And it comes from the idea that when a bunch of penguins are standing on top of an iceberg and they're starting to get a little hungry, they're not quite sure if there's anything dangerous in the waters. And so eventually one gets hungry enough that he or she goes in, and all the other penguins look to see whether that penguin comes up safely. And if that penguin does, then they all go in as well, because you just don't know what's going to be in the waters. And some companies actually give the first penguin award to people who take a risk. I love it. I just think these kinds of things are so visual. What is the mistake of the month? What is the first penguin? And by making them very visual and very easy to talk about, you're really setting an example as a leader.
Yeah. And, you know, and I love that you're and thank you for sharing this. I mean, I just love the catchy names for all of these and the Mistake of the Month Club. And, you know, talking about, you know, high-profile young companies like Google are such great examples. And then as you were talking, it dawned on me that 3M, maker of Post-it notes and many other fabulous products, right? They're an older company. I mean, they're more than 100 years old now. But they were founded on exactly this principle. This has been key to their innovation success. So, you know, it's a principle that's really important, and it's great to hear that, you know, young companies are using it, and I love that you put it in there as something that, like, any leader could start using. And, I mean, so many organizations are looking for ways to be more innovative, and you're giving them a really nice tool that you can use on kind of a small scale or a large scale to encourage some innovation.
And Christine, if I could comment on that, you're right. You probably run into a lot of this, too, with your clients, that they're looking for ways to be more innovative, right? And
yeah.
So sometimes we'll get requests for, you know, will you come in and, you know, do a workshop on how to be more innovative? And when we really kind of pull back the onion and look at what's really going on, we often find that the culture is one that is really fear-based. People are afraid to make mistakes. So they're not being innovative. They have the ability to, or the potential to, but they're afraid to step out and be that first penguin or make that, you know, mistake of the month. So something as simple as a tool like this, and you see this doesn't cost anything. This is, you know, a tool that you can just, you know, implement yourself and model it. It can go a long way to fostering more innovation in your company.
That's a great example. Thank you, Margaret.
Christine, if you don't mind, I'd love to jump on the back of that. And
sure.
We talk about it. All three of us know this and recognize this, I think, in our own work, in our own businesses, and also in the clients we work with. But what I think is really exciting, probably for all three of us, is that, yes, this works. It's effective to implement a more learning mindset and a more it's okay to fail if you're learning something from it, that kind of mindset. But not only is this effective, it is backed up by over 100 studies. It's not just a handful of studies. It's not just one or two studies. There are over 100 studies that demonstrate that having a learning mindset, as opposed to, and I guess we haven't really talked about the other side of it, as opposed to having a performance mindset, where all you feel that you need to do is demonstrate mastery. How am I good at this? As opposed to, how can I learn mastery? How can I grow even better at this? Those two are so different that study after study backs up that you will get more success and you will be more open to challenges and you will be more resilient when you do fail, when you do have this learning mindset.
Thank you for that, Senya. That's such a great way of talking about this. And I think what I especially love in what you guys are saying here is you're talking about, you know, how you have that learning mindset and overcome the culture of a fear-based kind of organization at the organization level, right? Because so many people are starting to see some of the research about the learning mindset maybe a little bit more applied to the individual. And so here you're giving a tool for leaders to use in their organizations to begin creating that learning mindset together as an organization. And I think that's a fabulous way to help people get started with that.
I'd add a small comment. This is Senya again. I'd add a small comment. Which is, if you are listening to Christine's call and you are a manager of a group and you don't quite believe, I've had this come up in a group that I taught a workshop to, and you don't quite believe that at the highest level of the organization there is a willingness to fail, you can still implement that in your group, in your department. So Margaret and I are huge believers in the start small, start anywhere philosophy. You can do all sorts of things with your group. Regardless, it's not against your organization, but you can do things even if you don't feel that it is a worldwide phenomenon yet.
Yes, and that's why we call it, you know, be the positive deviant. Go ahead, be it, and you don't need permission.
Yeah, that's great. I love that phrase too. Well, you know, we're just going to have another call, I think, because you just got so many good things to talk about. But before we actually wrap up, what I want to do is just open it up to a couple of questions from people who are listening in. And then given that we might not have time for everything that people want to talk about, I'll set up a place online. If it's okay with you guys, Senya and Margaret, I'll set up a little place online on either LinkedIn or Facebook and let people, if there's any questions we don't get to, in the next few minutes, let people ask you a few more. Is that okay? Or even I'll even let people email me and send them on to you or something.
Absolutely. We'd love that. We love when sparks of ideas from the book or from discussions like this with you continue. So, yes, absolutely.
And Christine, we love too when people share how they are using the tools, like specifically within their company or themselves. We'd love to hear those. And there's a place on our website called Tell Us Your PFTP Story.
Oh,
and,
terrific.
People have been posting some stories there, and, you know, they just, you know, they can be a few sentences or a few paragraphs. But we'd love to hear also how they're applying some of the tools.
Great. All right. Good. We'll try to get you some more stories. So let me see. I'm going to try to unmute everybody right now. Okay. Everyone, you're going, including Cindy and Margaret, I think you're going to have to press star six. Do it. Okay, everybody, if you would like to ask Cindy and Margaret a question, and we just have a few minutes, would you please press star six? And Cindy and Margaret, I'm going to need you to do the same. Okay, so people aren't able to unmute right now. Let me see. Ah, I got you all unmuted. Okay. Are you guys there?
Can you hear us?
Okay, terrific. So do we have anybody listening in that would like to ask a question? Sometimes.
Hi, I have a question.
Great.
This is Sandy Lewis. How are you guys?
Hi, Sandy.
Hey, Sandy. Hi.
Hi. So for anyone else listening, I also was part of the MAP program. I am also in business, and I've applied quite a few of these tools. I think it's fabulous. My question to you, though, is when you're seeing companies applying positive psychology tools to their workplaces, are you seeing it more in smaller startups? Are you seeing larger companies starting to integrate into their programs? Can you comment on that?
Sure. Sandy, this is Margaret. Senya works with a lot of high-tech, you know, startups out on the West Coast. I tend to work in large corporations on the East Coast. So they've been applied in both settings, both with, you know, clients that we coach and their teams, as well as beginning to incorporate it into leadership curriculum.
Fantastic.
I'll second what Margaret's saying. I work with Google, Intel, and VMware. So in large technology companies, I am seeing this either in a group setting. Oh, how can we learn more about a concept that's better than goals? Or how can we learn more about the learning mindset or more about productivity? And in executive coaching, so in individual coaching, I'm seeing especially a lot, and I've seen this continuously, about productivity. People are just really concerned about their productivity and how can they get more done while still being able to work on their own strategic goal. So I'd say both in larger technology companies and for individual managers within technology companies, as well as for entrepreneurs, the concepts I'm seeing are productivity.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you guys for that. All right. I could take one more quick question, and otherwise we will put the questions online. Do we have another quick question from Margaret and Senya? All right. Sometimes people are a little shy on the call. Hard to believe, but we can pick this up online as well. Margaret and Senya, I just want to say, I'm talking today with Margaret Greenberg and Senya Maimon. They are the authors of a fabulous new book, Profit from the Positive, Proven Leadership Strategies to Boost Productivity and Transform Your Business. And I highly recommend this book to any leader, anybody who works with a business, in a business. It's got a lot of great tools. You've heard about some of them here today. We obviously couldn't get through even half of what they've got in the book. But it's really a fresh new set of approaches to leadership and management and even managing change. So Margaret and Senya, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. And I know people have learned a lot from this and will be learning a lot. We'll post this online so people can listen in again.
Thank you, Christine.
Thanks, Christine, and thanks for being a positive deviant. I am so glad you are doing this work as well. I really am. I know the concepts that you said you'd liked in the book, but I've also spoken to you about your own work in business, and I'm just so glad to see you and us and Sandy doing this, bringing these concepts to people who otherwise wouldn't know them.
Oh, well, thanks for that, Senya. And, you know, it's just like wrapping that thought up, I think, you know, one of the things I think all of us see are clients who, you know, may have been willing to be a positive deviant themselves, right, who were willing to try some of these approaches. Mm-hmm. And then they see what they get from it, and they can become pretty zealous, right? I mean, they experience it. They see the results they get. They see how they feel using some of these approaches. And so it's a win-win-win, I think.
Yes, let's gather the zealots. Let's get them together.
Okay, and Christine, well, can I just mention that for the callers on the line that there are a number of free tools on our website by the same name as the book, profitfromthepositive.com. And we also have a Facebook page by the same name, profitfromthepositive.com, where people can kind of follow latest research and articles we post and photos and where we're going to be next.
Terrific. That's great, Senya and Margaret. Thank you for that. And, you know, it occurred to me, I'm just going to throw one thing out here at the end. You know, you were talking earlier about edge walkers, and I discovered that something that I'm doing in May is actually pretty new. And I'm doing it for a university. I'm a sustaining faculty for something that's called a MOOC, a massive online open course. It'll be for 3 weeks in May. It's for women leaders or aspiring women leaders. But I just found out from some corporate folks that that's kind of also one of the leading edge things approaches that they're looking into for training people in corporations. So these MOOCs are free. The one I'll be doing will be free. I'll put some stuff online, and you know, if people are on my list, I'll certainly update you about that. So just want
to
put
I'd
that out
there.
I'd love
to hear more about that.
Oh, that's
okay.
Lovely. Yeah.
Terrific. Yeah, Profit from the Positive can be its own MOOC. Okay. All right. Well, thank you again, both of you, very much. And thanks to those of you that are listening in today. And have a great – oh, and Margaret, you sent the son to Boston. Thank you.
Oh, great. Wow, I didn't know I had that much influence.
This call was really powerful. Thank you.
Thank you, Christine. Thank you, Senya.
You're
all
welcome.
Best.
All right. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Have a best day.
Bye. Bye.